You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Today on From Embers, you'll hear a recording of a talk given at an anti-colonial Thanksgiving dinner event last month by a Métis anarchist. And the second half of the episode, you'll hear our conversation about a few different things: nations and nationalism, the politics of reconciliation, the state, and anarchist possibilities or approaches to decolonization. I know it's Thanksgiving in the United States this week, so maybe some of you are already taking the opportunity to reflect on that particular settler colonial celebration, or the ongoing colonization of this territory, or about the role of your life and your actions, both in terms of your place in this world and your relations, whether you're a settler or otherwise, and in the struggle for decolonization. Hopefully, this talk provides some interesting or challenging ideas to guide those reflections. I know it gave me a lot to think about. So let's get to it. Here's the talk.
Jeanang no dinakwe in additionakas, mitchif nehio indao, gawin ning kenemasin indodem, kisiskachuan a seepin in Dunjaba Hamilton inda. My Indian name is Southern Wind Woman. I am mitchif Cree. I don't know my clan. My family comes from Saskatchewan, Meadow Lake specifically, and I live in Hamilton now. So that's what I just said. And I introduced myself in Anishinaabe Mohan because I got that name at an Ojibwe Sundance Lodge, which is a community that I've been accepted into in these territories. I have mixed French, Scottish, and Swedish heritage. Furthermore, I identify as queer, two-spirit interchangeably. I use she and her pronouns. So I'm an organizer, a proud feminist, and an anarchist. So over the years, I've been intimately involved in a wide range of movements, from animal liberation to land defense, indigenous sovereignty, fights against patriarchy, and pushback against gentrification. I see all of those struggles as connected in one way or another. But before I start, I want to take a few seconds, one, to reflect on knowledge and the creation of it in our communities. What you'll hear me speak on tonight is a work in progress, and you can be sure that in 6 months from now, I'm going to have different feelings and new thoughts about it, because ideas aren't static. And it's also important to acknowledge that our individual realities limit our ability to comprehend the diverse networks of knowledge that inform other people's lives. So tonight, I'm up here speaking, and what I'll say will be attributed to me, but what's lost are like the hundreds of hours of debate and support and reflection that other friends and comrades have acted in with me. So it's important for me to remember that knowledge isn't created by individuals, but by communities. And so actually, because I believe these things, I decided this morning this is going to be my last speaking event for the rest of the year. I've been honored, I think, with a lot of opportunities to share my opinion this year. And I think it's probably my time to like sit back and listen and reflect. And the winter is a great time to practice that humility. So I decided that this morning. Before I get started, I want to thank a few people, like the whole ACT crew, for pulling this dinner together every year, particularly Dev, for advocating I'd be called to speak. And I want to thank my community in Hamilton, specifically my friend Cedar and also Maddie, for helping me bounce around a lot of these ideas, and everyone else who showed up, which is really rad. Also my partner David for standing with me through a lot of really heavy ceremony this year that has given me just as much insight to all these ideas as books. So one last just important thank you to Carolyn King for speaking and also your work in asserting the rights of Anishinaabe peoples in these territories, which is, I think, a history that's often erased in Hamilton by Haudenosaunee title to those lands. So that's really, really important. And also the Wiji Namgo Ukwe drumming group for the traditional opening. So thank you. And I just want to preface it by saying that maybe some of the things I'm going to say tonight might be challenging, maybe even upsetting to some people. And if it is, I apologize, but I was also offered tobacco to speak tonight. And so I have to speak my truth, and that is what I'm going to say. So I was asked to come and speak to you tonight about reconciliation. And I think it's important for me to begin this talk by telling you that I actually have no interest in reconciliation at this time. And that I think the concept is essentially a state-led smokescreen used to advance a more sophisticated policy of assimilation. So tonight, I actually want to talk about reconciliation, decolonization, the difference between those two things, and also the role that the state plays in that. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, actually, there's a book copy of the report back there on the table, was formed in 2007 after residential school survivors won the largest class action lawsuit in Canadian history. And they modeled it after the post-apartheid Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, which is fitting, seeing as how South Africa looked to the Canadian reservation infrastructure to develop their own racist and segregated system. So as most of us know, the TRC concluded with 94 actionable measures that the government, educational institutions, and individuals could take to pursue reconciliation between settler and Indigenous communities, and immediately, universities started implementing new curriculum about colonization, and Trudeau started wearing shorter sleeves so we could all see his Haida Raven tattoo, and land acknowledgements began popping up everywhere on everyone's letterheads. And most recently, the Government of Canada released their 10 points of official reconciliation, which is a document that I'll refer back to briefly tonight. So I am honored to sit here tonight and tell you that reconciliation as we know it today is an impossible lie. Official Canadian reconciliation centers on accepting the past, apologizing, and moving forward together. It doesn't necessitate the physical reparations of the history of colonization, and in fact, it mostly looks at discussions of those kinds as counterproductive or divisive or difficult. But there exists a fundamental problem because settler colonialism doesn't exist in the past. Its violence is pervasive and ongoing. It's happening today, everywhere we look. And reconciliation, treating it as though we are apologizing for something that's in the past and moving on, is just an erasure of that current ongoing settler colonial violence. Reconciliation as a term is about resolving a conflict back to a state of friendly relations. It can also mean the bringing together of two positions so as to make them compatible. Decolonization, on the other hand, is about repealing the authority of the Canadian state and redistributing land and resources. And it also means embracing and legitimizing previously repressed Indigenous worldviews. And it's not a light word. If we think about what colonization actually is, it's the complete economic and administrative domination of a people in place. So repealing that's a big deal. But nevertheless, you'll often see these two words just thrown around almost interchangeably in people's rhetoric, especially I find in the university context where people using them aren't actually actors in struggle. I would argue that that's inappropriate. The occupying and dominating force in our context is the state of Canada. So I don't see the creation of the Canadian state as coinciding with the signing of the British North America Act in 1867. It was a slow process of institution building that began at first settlement. And Confederation was just the official recognition of that process. But a state, you know, we use this word a lot. Not all the time are we using it with the proper understanding of what it is. So when I talk about state tonight in this context, I'll be talking about a compulsory political organization. It has a centralized government. It has a monopoly on the legitimate use of force within a territory, and it maps out that territory with borders. And that's what Canada is. A secondary to that are like public declarations of love for poutine and jokes about affinity for beavers. You know, zoos are colonial institutions as well, and they used to hold humans. Facts, you can look it up if you want. A lot of Indigenous humans and Africans. And trying to shed the baggage of that violent and racist origin, they later rebranded themselves as educational facilities and conservation facilities. But a zoo will always be a zoo. Canada was created in order to govern, exploit, and expand the territories that it settled and stole from Indigenous peoples of this land. It wasn't a byproduct. That was its primary function. And it still is. It always will be. It can't escape that. So how can a state, the Canadian state, reconcile with Indigenous peoples? They certainly can't go back to a state of friendly relations because there never existed such a time, in my opinion. Reconciliation can only mean eliminating the conflict by enmeshing settler and Indigenous communities together, which is that second version of the definition that I shared. Essentially, this means assimilating Indigenous peoples by having them give up their claims to sovereignty for the promise of economic equality within Canada as citizens. And it means Canadian people get to devour Indigenous ideas and symbols into their own settler stories, their own Canadiana. And this is really the only path possible under the Canadian state. The return of land and the power to govern said lands could never be possible under this structure. The resource-based frameworks, which define land and water under the logic of capitalism, could never be reconciled with giving away that much money to Indigenous nations. And the state-based frameworks, which define territory under the nation state, could never be reconciled with giving away that much power. It just couldn't happen. So I don't actually just want to sit up here today and lecture you the entire time. I actually want you to be politically engaged with these ideas and thinking about your own politics tonight. Realistically, what I'm offering you is a challenge to your own frameworks of justice and good enough. I posit that you actually have to decide which of these ideas you're pursuing. Are you interested in reconciliation with Indigenous peoples, or are you looking towards decolonization? The words aren't interchangeable, and we actually have to stop using them that way. And I also don't see those two ideas as compatible or complementary. They aren't, in my opinion, some part of some mythical umbrella of left progressivism. One is calling for the continuation of the Canadian state and the other one for its abolition. So this goes beyond simply saying you're fighting for decolonization too. I'm going to argue that your politics actually matter. If you believe in Canadian democracy, if you believe the system works but it's just broken, if you believe that voting in another electoral party candidate is truly going to make a difference for Indigenous peoples, then you aren't interested in decolonization. It doesn't just mean anti-capitalist. In my opinion, decolonization means anti-state. And the first of these opinions is relatively uncontroversial in activist circles. It's something that we accept. But the second one is kind of what gets people. So I'll address that a little bit. To those who feel as though what I'm saying is too binary, that there's still good to be done under the system of Canada, I offer you the logic of Canada's 10 points of official reconciliation and ask you to ponder the question of rights. We can look together at some of these points. 1, Canada recognizes Indigenous rights to self-determination. 2, Canada sees reconciliation as fundamental to Section 35 of the Constitution Act. 3, Canada recognizes it needs to act with integrity. 4, Canada sees Indigenous self-government as part of the federalism of the provinces. 5, it says it needs to uphold the treaties. 6 and 7, I'll come back to. 8, desires to construct a new fiscal relationship. 9, recognizes that reconciliation is flexible. And 10, Canada recognizes that Indigenous peoples are all different. I chose not to read out the expanded points of this list because I think it's generally useless and boring, and a perfect example of the bureaucratic skill of using an abundance of words to say absolutely nothing. But I would encourage you to peruse it on your own if you feel so inclined. And if you do, pay particular attention to the careful use of phrase to describe where Indigenous peoples fit into this imagination of the post-reconciliation utopia. For all the fancy wording, there's no promise of sovereignty. Only money that will bring Indigenous people up to the standard of living of Canadians, that they're readily available and willing to be absorbed into the project of Canada. To illustrate this, I give you a quote from point 2. Reconciliation is an ongoing process through which Indigenous peoples and the Crown work cooperatively to establish and maintain a mutually respectful framework for living together, with a view to fostering strong, healthy, sustainable Indigenous nations within a strong Canada. And there are different incarnations of this subtle assertion of Canadian supremacy in points 2, 3, 4, 8, and 10. So let's go back to points 6 and 7, which I said were arguably the most important in the document. Well, point 6 talks about securing free, prior, and informed consent of Indigenous peoples in regards to their land when Canada wants to take it, develop it, or exploit it. And this wordy section is full of really nice phrases like consensus and consent, collaboration, cooperation, consultation. It actually has all of those in one little section. But point 7, a much shorter section that comes right after that, immediately revokes that false commitment. It says that consultation is an aspiration and that control of land supposedly held by Indigenous peoples can be overridden in any situation beneficial to the Canadian government. Indigenous peoples, even under the banner of reconciliation, do not have the right to say no to the state of Canada. The right to say no is critical to the realization of sovereignty, of freedom, of consent, any of those things. But it should actually come as no surprise to Canadians who are paying attention states operate on the illusion of rights. The government has the right to seize your property too, even as a settler. It can expropriate any piece of land that it needs to serve its goals of economic expansion, whether that be a dam or a highway or an airport or a pipeline. That's because rights given to you by the government can be taken away by the government. These rights aren't real, it's fake freedom. It's my belief that there can be no reconciliation that recognizes self-determination of Indigenous people so long as the state of Canada exists. And once embraced, I think that pushes you towards radical and revolutionary politics in search of answers. And I'll admit, I remain skeptical as an anarchist, but I spend a good deal of time listening to try to envision what a lot of my communist comrades meant when they talked about revolution. I asked them where Indigenous nations fit into their hope for their proletariat-dictated state. I asked them how this new world would make space for Indigenous worldviews or land-based spiritualities. I asked them how they intended on sharing power or returning land. And time again, I was convinced through their insufficient or non-existent answers to those questions that their proletariat-dictated state would be no better for the people or the earth than the liberal capitalist one we have now. Many times they would tell me that the return of land was paramount to upholding the justice of this new communist state, but the mechanisms for handing back that land were missing. In this new state where land was to be publicly seized and redistributed among working class settlers, where was the room to authoritatively give away huge sections of it to sovereign entities without sparking massive settler entitlement provoked unrest? Many times they counter that argument by saying there was more than enough crown land to give back to Indigenous nations, that they wouldn't have to give away cityscapes or farmland. They fail to realize that much of that crown land is the site of massive resource wealth. And an industrial communist state, of which we can almost definitely expect, would need to produce prosperity in order to ensure a counter-revolution didn't just quickly take over its new central authority. And would it not need resources in order to keep people happy and fuel the grand people's military? These are all huge problems, and the picture they paint never made me very enthusiastic for their coming red revolution. But most importantly, they don't begin to address the fundamental conflict. And that conflict is actually the same conflict that the Canadian state faces now in its own reconciliatory rhetoric. Even if this land known as Canada were to be chopped in half and half returned to Indigenous nations, the relationship between a dense centralized state and a diverse heterogeneous group of communities was always going to remain a gross imbalance of power. There is no nation-to-nation relationship. It's one of nation-to-nations. In addressing this problem, communists always point to the same tired solutions that Canadians do, insisting that Indigenous people will just form new federations like the AFN, which will help to liaise between the parties. I am not inspired by this solution. Since the early days of the colonial project, settlers have been trying to figure out how Indigenous governance works. And when they did figure it out, they didn't like it. It took too long. It was too fluid. It didn't govern the principles of property and ownership in a way that was conducive to their mission. And with the realization of the Indian Act, settlers set up neo-colonial governments called band councils to replace traditional governance systems. These were elected positions based on representational democracy mirrored to the settler system. They considered this and only this legitimate, and they enforced that legitimacy through coercive authority, often at gunpoint. Over time, with the Canadian state swelling to the unimaginable size that it has now through the pillaging of stolen resources, many Indigenous nations tried to gain legitimacy by forming associations that were mirrored on these Eurocentric modes of governance. You have the Allied Nations of BC or the Indian Association Alberta or the Métis Nation of Ontario, of which I'm a part, culminating in the UN-inspired Assembly of First Nations, the AFN. The AFN doesn't represent the needs and desires of Indigenous people, just in the same way the Canadian government doesn't represent Canadians. Representational democracy is a far cry from rule by the people. Pipeline Perry is busy handing over Eagle staffs to Justin Trudeau and thanking him for his charity, while the rest of the assembly works with the RCMP to outland defenders across Turtle Island. Now, I don't blame our elders and community leaders for trying to do good for Indigenous people through the only system allowed by Canada, which is the current occupying force. But it's not a secret that these systems also breed corruption. For as many good and decent people that there are in those positions, when people are kept powerless on purpose, there will always be those who crave authority of the colonizer. But luckily, as long as there have been the forcefully implemented Democracy of Band Council or the False Nations of the MNO or the coerced federalism of bodies like the AFN, there's been Indigenous people and communities that have been fighting to dismantle them and fighting to return back to systems of traditional governance, which are smaller in size and based on belonging in a community. Which brings me to anarchism. Anarchism is a political philosophy, some might say a beautiful idea, that believes in self-governed societies based on voluntary association with one another. It advocates for non-hierarchical decision-making, direct participation in those decisions by communities, and autonomy for all living persons. Furthermore, it leaves space for the valuation of non-human entities beyond their monetary worth or usefulness to human beings. My Indigenous teachings have communicated to me that our communities are important, but so are we as individuals. Traditional ways saw decision-making as a participatory process based on consensus where communities made choices together. My teachings tell me that the land can offer us what we need, but never to take more than that. And I see these ideas as fundamentally compatible. Anarchism envisions a world where there exist systems of land stewardship, but not ownership. A world where there are territories, but not borders. Although sticking with my conceptual tool, I could call this association one of nations to nations. That wouldn't be quite accurate either. Anarchists don't believe in nations. But I would actually argue that neither do Indigenous folks. The word nation is a funny one, imposed on Indigenous communities as the most comprehensible label for their form of political organization, and it's useful in some contexts, but it's often not, and it has never quite fit. Indigenous communities used to meet each spring to negotiate territories, form new agreements, and redistribute resources. Not all, of course. Sometimes they just burn down their neighbors' houses when they wanted them to move out. I'm not here tonight to romanticize some sort of pre-contact utopia free from oppression and conflict. But the conception of their nations was far different than the Westphalian model followed and imposed by Western society. Decisions were made by communities, resources were shared, membership was fluid, and adoption common. Leaders were seen as spokespeople or advocates more than authorities. Positions of honor were given to those with lifelong demonstration of service, wisdom, and integrity, and those positions were also revocable. It's possible to reconcile this with an anarchist idea of legitimate authority. This wasn't anarchy exactly as we know it, but it was close in some ways. So it comes to figure then that both liberal and Marxist theorists have found a story to explain away the validity of such societies. Liberals were fond of social Darwinist theories of societal evolution that saw my ancestors as stuck in a stage of savagery. Marxists preferred the historical materialism theory to claim that Indigenous societies were just a form of primitive communism, which would need to evolve through capitalism to reach the ever more respectable industrial communism that they imagine. I'd like to challenge this framework instead and impose a circular view of history embraced by my Indigenous teachings. I don't think we need to go back along a linear timeline of so-called progression. There is no going back. We can't go backwards. But I want to return to the ideas of my ancestors and see it as moving forward, or maybe just movement directionless. I'd like to see an anarchy of my people alongside the anarchy of settlers, who are also my people, enacted here side by side together with an equal distribution of power, each pursuing healthy relationships, acting from their own ideas and history, just as the two were really imagined. I would like to see the centralized state of Canada dismantled. I'd like to see communities take up the responsibility of organizing themselves in the absence of said central authority, community councils meeting weekly to discuss the needs of the community and the limitations of the land to meet those needs, with a renewed emphasis on staying within those limits. Decisions made on consensus with a more active participation from all persons. Participation made more accessible by the lessening of work necessary with the return to subsistence economy rather than one of accumulation. More conversation, more cooperation, more shared production. A system that might have regional communication and collaboration, but that always has an emphasis on the primacy of the community to make decisions and value decisions for themselves. I think beautiful things would follow from these changes naturally. I think that if it were up to communities to decide whether it was worth it to open a gravel pit in their territory, if it meant risking our only water supply, we would just see less gravel pits. The violence of a centralized authority means that they have the ability to create sacrifice zones without a thought. Even in this lovely future, there would still be conflict because conflict is a constant and that's okay. Not all newly sovereign communities, indigenous or settler, would immediately institute some sort of reciprocal relationship with the planet, because as we know, there are plenty of indigenous capitalists out there alongside settlers. But the new relationship to place and focus on interdependence will give settlers a chance to genuinely form a new connection to this land base, to adopt their own traditions and values that deal with the ethics of consumption and growth. And over time, I think that we would see the blending together of communities of settlers and indigenous folks who committed themselves to the same ideas. The love of land would bring some people closer, and the new side of conflict would be less based on a racialized claim to land and more based on defending a worldview that called for its defense. So like this is the point where I actually think the word reconciliation is appropriate to use between our communities. So I identify as Michif Cree, and I always list my other European ancestry when I speak to people. Sometimes other indigenous folks have asked me why I don't just claim myself as a Nahio Escuello, as like a Cree woman, but I tell them that I want to find ways to honor my mother's ancestors. And it was always important to my grandfather that we remember we are Métis and to be proud of that. And I am proud to be Métis. The Cree is to call us Ote Pemasawak, which means those who govern themselves. And my direct ancestors and their communities waged a commendable resistance against the early Canadian state. They lived a hard life on the margins of society, and they paid dearly for their resistance, surviving as squatters for almost 60 years. They called them the road allowance people. To be Métis means that I walk in two worlds, and I think that that's a gift. I didn't always think that, but I do now. I learned so much from my political community in Hamilton, constantly expanding my ideas and challenging me to take bigger risks. And I learned so much from my ceremony families at New Credit or at Chippewa of the Thames or at Kippewa, digging deep into a lot of my own healing and my own responsibilities. And a lot of the times I wish I could bring these two communities together more. I think they both have things to learn from each other, but it's really, really hard. It takes a constant vigilance to both urge my settler friends to reconnect with land and spirit and to guard against them assuming too much. I really love the phrase becoming indigenous to place, but I still can't bring myself to use it. I just won't. I think it's dangerous, and I think people are too irresponsible. The thing is, I don't think settlers need to co-opt indigenous worldviews or to start using our forms of governance. I actually really think anarchism can provide us with a political system parallel and harmonious, a set of ideas that can also allow for us to acknowledge the interdependence of the earth and to find new values based on that sacred connection. And again, it's not about going back. It's about taking the knowledge that has survived and using it to create a more beautiful and just future for all of us. The Canadian state can't reconcile with Indigenous communities, but you can as individuals. And it starts with you making choices autonomously and with conviction. Maybe you go home and you decide tonight that you still believe in supporting Canadian state-led reconciliation, regardless of what I said, because who cares, right? Okay, but own it. You know, own it and don't make yourself out to be a revolutionary because your ideas aren't. And maybe you decide to leave here tonight and take your politics a little more seriously, or maybe you're already an anarchist and everything I said was a reminder or a validation. And to you, I say, remember your politics and choose your allies carefully. Saying you support Indigenous sovereignty doesn't mean backing every Indigenous person on every project. There are plenty of Indigenous misogynists out there and ladder-climbing politicians, and it doesn't do me any good when you support them and help them gain power. So I ask you to fight for liberatory ideas and not necessarily for nations or bloodlines. And we do this all the time already. This isn't actually a big deal. There are Indigenous people out there who oppose pipelines and people who support them. And we always align ourselves as environmentalists with the resistance. So we are making choices already. That's okay too. Just like own that. It's okay to like want to fight for land and for freedom. But it also means you have to do your homework. So understand what struggles are about and know who's participating in them. Get to know those people, build relationships, build meaningful relationships outside of the occupation, like as friends. It can't start from a place of white guilt, and you can't let yourself get swept up in your own settler redemption story. Remember that fighting for a future that sees justice for Indigenous communities is not just done as comrades in their struggles. It's a politic that you should live every day. And you can do this without speaking on their behalf. You can be thoughtful and you can be creative. And whenever possible, just work to undermine and attack the Canadian state in all of your work. Because this is actually the work of decolonization, in my opinion. And it's actually where you'll find your own liberation, too. This is actually your government, not theirs. And it shouldn't just be their responsibility to tear it down. Marcy, thank you. That's all I have to say.
Yet there were no states, but there was warfare, and whenever they were at war, they were always at war with a stateless enemy.
The final frontier. The final frontier. The final frontier.
I guess one of the most interesting parts about that for me was your discussion of nations and what those are and how indigenous forms of governance have maybe not really corresponded with ideas of what nations are. I guess I'm curious about what you understand a nation to be, even if not like a modern nation state, but in terms of a people using that definition for themselves.
Yeah, I think this is interesting, and there was actually a really long article written last year, I believe. It was entitled How Indigenous Nationhood Can Save the World, something along those lines. And I don't agree 100% with what's written in that article, but it was interesting in terms of the author was breaking down the differences between what Indigenous nations see themselves as and the like Westphalian model of nation states that we see. And it's not the first time I've heard that exact same thing either. And I think that it's complicated because I think that the word nation has been one that's imposed or one that was chosen as the most sensical at the time to describe what our communities are. But I would say that for the most part, the sense of like nationhood doesn't lead to the same sense of the need to like conquer and control territory in the same way, because the concepts of ownership are not the same. And so you have a group of people that are bound together by a history and a land base and kinship ties and a shared culture and a shared vision of, like, what is a good life necessarily. And they, those people will share a territory or have a loose idea of where their territory ends and begins. But they also negotiate those boundaries every year and also can move around. And membership was a lot more fluid. So you have that, like, inherent sense of belonging, but I think that what follows from that is not the same. I would counter my own points by saying that I also have seen the adoption of the term nation by some certain Indigenous communities and have them really embrace a sense of, like, nationhood and also, like, a nationalism that has much more clearly defined boundaries of membership based on race, based on blood quantum, and has much more intense ideas of property and of territorial boundaries and of ownership. And it seems more so that there are some communities that actually would be interested in forging their own nation in the very, like, European sense. So while I do believe that the word nation was imposed and that for the most part, when you hear people talking about their nations and sovereignty for our nations, it's not the same thing. They're not looking to establish their own state. They're looking to go back to more of a stateless system. But I do think that there are certain Indigenous communities that definitely have a pretty destructive nationalist bent to them.
I think those questions have big implications for what it would look like to relate to settlers or other communities of people without a state, because the idea of, like, white ethnic nations is horrifying to me, but is also somewhat compatible with, yeah, these ideas of, like, ethnic nationalism broadly or something. And
yeah, exactly. It's a terrifying proposition, and I think, and at the end of my speech, I gave this, you know, probably condescending, but whatever, little group of tips of, like, if you want to be, like, in solidarity with Indigenous folks, like, do these things. But I very clearly said, don't just support every Indigenous person on every project or, like, every sovereignty struggle that they have. You actually have to be aware, and you have to understand. Figure out when what the person means when they say nation that you're working with. I think they're, like, fine questions to ask if you have relationships with those people. And it's important to actually know, especially because I do think that those kinds of terms have broad set of meanings. So it's important to be specific.
I was wondering if you could go into a bit more detail of the vision of sort of these federated or representative groups of Indigenous nations that would be required by any state in order to negotiate claims of land or resource exploitation or things like that. I guess, do you see that kind of mediation as an essential part of the strategy on the part of the state? And how do you see that working?
I'll use the example of the Métis Nation of Ontario, because that's technically my nation. Métis politics are very interesting. It's essentially been decades-long struggle just for recognition from the Canadian state in a way that other nations, a lot of other nations, have not had to wage that same fight. What I've seen in that time period were a lot of wins and a lot of self-respect and joy and pride come back to, like, a lot of Métis communities that maybe wasn't there before. And so I don't want to knock the people who have fought Supreme Court challenges to obtain harvesting rights or have fought Supreme Court challenges to be considered an Indian under the Indian Act. But at the same time, those wins have come with a huge degree of sacrifices that were given over by these governing bodies, like the Métis Nation of Ontario. One of those, I would say, was pretty, it was a self-chosen thing. I wouldn't say it was particularly coerced, but there was definitely a move to make these governing bodies mirror the European system as much as possible. So our elders were called senators, and they're now called knowledge keepers. We've come back from that. But many, many things were very, like, Europeanized. But these governing bodies, the Métis Nation of Ontario, which I'm allowed to vote once a year in an electoral system to elect the next president, who is then therefore to advocate on my behalf. These governing bodies are completely in bed with the extractive industry project that the government wants to push through. And that's really strategic because they want rights recognized by the government. And so they feel like that's an easy thing to give over. And so I also get emails from them a couple of times a year with job opportunities for Indigenous youth up in Northern Ontario, being a community liaison for some new mine they want to put in. And it makes me absolutely sick. There has been a bit of community pushback in the last few years. Christy Belcourt, whose grandfather actually founded the Métis Nation of Ontario, very like publicly cut up her membership card last year. So did her daughter, in protest of this like non-representational system. But because of the geography of Métis people spread out across Canada, and because of the federal government seeing us now as under their jurisdiction, but needing like carefully constructed boundaries of which communities are which, we have this thing where there's a Métis Nation of Ontario, there's a Métis or Manitoba Métis Federation, and so we're divided up by province. So even though my family is technically would be from Saskatchewan, if I went back to my like Métis community where the majority of my family lives and where they were historically, because I live in Ontario now, I applied to the Ontario Federation. And this is all just necessary because of the scope of the federal government. If they're going to like advocate for their rights, well, this is what they're going to have to do. But I think that it just like fails us as a community inherently. And I would like to see it done away with completely. I like really, really disavow the entire thing. And the problem is that within the context of any state, as I also said in my speech, even a communist state, the solutions that been put forward by me were the same. And that's because it would just be so hard. The bureaucracy would be so much for a centralized state to deal with, you know, dozens of communities who all have different needs and wishes in Ontario, or communities that are spread out across Canada but still consider themselves one community. That it needs to be simplified. And the most simple way for the government to categorize people and put them into little blocks or voting blocks is to establish these kind of federations, either modeled after the Canadian system or the UN system. But I think it fundamentally is just incompatible with, one, being responsive to what a community actually wants and desires, and like two, to actually represent individuals either.
Challenges that you can envision in terms of building that relationship between settlers and Indigenous people in a non-oppressive way or without domination?
I think that actually one of the like huge glaring problems with the way that most of the left engages with Indigenous people is that they don't have an answer to what decolonization looks like for them, because they cannot imagine big enough a future that would not involve some sort of centralized state. And that's really sometimes because they don't believe that's a viable form of social organization, but a lot of the times it's because they actually just like can't, they don't have the frameworks for it, nor have they explored those questions themselves. And so there's a lot of championing of, you know, we need to decolonize, or we need to make sure that we are like applying a decolonial lens to this issue. And then they want to do land acknowledgements, and they want to bring in speakers, and they want to do all of these things. But there's a certain point at which all of their rhetoric would hit a dead end. And that point is usually the point where an Indigenous person brings up returning land, because they just don't understand how to do that. And I think what happens is in their journey of trying to support Indigenous peoples, what they primarily do is support them in trying to win more rights from the government, which I also think is just a dead-end game. I think like there are a certain number of rights the government will ever give Indigenous peoples, and there's a very clear line as to where those rights will stop being handed out. Land return is just never going to happen. That is impossibility under the current existence of the Canadian state. And so if there is someone who's out there who is just real excited about doing decolonial work and supporting Indigenous sovereignty movements, but still are supporting a future in which what that looks like is just like more rights given to them by the state, I think there's a hypocrisy that's just glaring in their analysis.
You're listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory, or you might be listening to the podcast edition. You can search for us in whatever podcast app you use, or you can check us out at fromembers.libsyn.com. We're also a part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Network, so check out channelzeronetwork.com if you like anarchist podcasts like this one and want to find more.
It seems that that part of that statecraft involves creating this Canadian nationalism that somehow is supposed to include Indigenous people as part of it, and that to me seems like a really shameless lie. But and what do you think are the implications of that project succeeding?
I mean, I think I see the implications of that everywhere all the time. I work at a university campus, and I see it's really hard for me to talk shit about this sort of work because I also do think they're doing something good, but we see the funding of Indigenous student centers on university campuses, and we see funding coming from the federal government to hire Indigenous people to fly into remote communities and give presentations and try to attract the Indigenous students to go to university. And this is kind of seen as like one of the biggest ways that we are going to like close this gap, you know. And so the government gets to paint this as like, look, we're spending all these dollars to try to increase Indigenous attendance at universities, which will increase their chances at success, which will empower their communities. And it's this very like trickle down thing. It will empower some of them and it'll empower the rest. And they get to look as though that's them addressing or providing some sort of reparation for this like historical difference in education. But then what happens is you have not only a bunch of Indigenous students that are going out of their communities and into big cities and then feeling a lot of the time pretty alienated and isolated, but you also have this narrative that's being pushed of like the only way to change your situation is to play the game, get your university degree, and then try to make money in order to like empower your community back home, or become an Indigenous social worker and go back into your community and help. And I think that the narrative of removing children or removing young adults from communities to be educated under a Canadian system is the only way to like empower and enrich Indigenous communities is just inherently very bad. But what that does is, you see it over and over again, is it creates this generation of Indigenous students who feel like it's their familial responsibility to get a degree, or maybe to be the first person in their family to get a degree. And it stops them a lot of the time from asserting more. They're told they're supposed to be grateful, that this is like a great opportunity for them that they need to study. So what I found a lot of the time is actually a real like quelling of dissent on university campuses through the Indigenous student centers. And that's just one example of the way that this sort of rhetoric channels this like new generation of Indigenous folks through and is like, this is how we're going to fix things. This is how things are going to be better. You just need to participate and don't cause too much trouble. So I think not only would the success of that project just essentially mean that Canada would have less reason to recognize or be afraid of or make concessions to Indigenous nations when they stand up for their rights, but also that Indigenous people might just feel less entitled to demand those things. And it's sad because a lot of people who I see in those positions, or the people who are elders at schools, are either children of or are survivors of the residential school system or era. And I don't blame them for just like wanting a better life or a life less filled with struggle for the younger generation. They're tired. They've like fought their fight. They're alive and that's fine. And then they're seeing these changes and they see it as a good thing. And, you know, nobody wants to like watch a younger generation go up against the same struggles as them. You want things to keep getting better. So I understand why they urge these students to just like take these opportunities and not cause trouble. But
I understand and respect your reluctance, I guess, when you were talking about how you like the phrase becoming Indigenous to place, but are hesitant to use it. Settlers and white people tend to assume too much and go too far in feeling entitled to people's cultural practices or community spaces or material resources or etc. I guess I'm curious if there are things that you think anarchists could or should learn from practices of indigenous governance that you've seen, or ways that you think that people could start to change the way they relate now, both in struggle with each other and in general in the world.
Yeah, I think the term becoming indigenous to place bothers me for the reasons you listed, but it also bothers me in this, I think, more like sinister way of this phenomena of people feeling as though they have to claim indigenous ancestry to be legitimate actors here. And I see this a lot. You see this a lot when you like go to ceremony or when you see people engaged in struggle. And I guess what I'm pushing back on is people's feelings that they need to do that. Yeah, I want people to feel as though there is a pathway for them to feel rooted to this place and want to defend it and want to build something better here without having to say that that's because they have some sort of ancestral right to be here. In terms of settlers borrowing things from indigenous governance, I kind of would just say, like, no. I'm not really sure it's necessary. I think that, first of all, if I'm putting forward a view of, like, some sort of anarchist future, I don't think it's necessarily viable for anarchists or settlers to adopt systems of governance that are at all related to kinship, unless they wanted to do that, you know? But then they would also have to probably determine different boundaries as to, like, what constitutes kin, if we're talking about groups of comrades coming together, things like that, you know? Although maybe over the years, things have changed. I think in a lot of ways, we already do have models that mirror indigenous systems, like, we operate on consensus. There are many books written about consensus organizing and coming to decisions. I think if anything, I guess if I could say one thing, I would touch on what I spoke to earlier, which is that an adoption of the understanding that process can take a very long time, not just hours, but maybe days or weeks before decisions get made, is actually something that I'm pretty in favor of. And I think that it seems sometimes to be completely ineffective and impossible under the current system we live now to take more time to make decisions and to bring everybody on board. And so we often, you know, have backup mechanisms to our consensus process. Well, but if we can't reach a decision, then we'll go 2/3 majority, which is fine necessarily. But that's there because the decision was going to take too long, not necessarily because a decision couldn't be reached. Although I think that sort of, like, the ability of that to come back into play might just become more realistic if we ever actually manage to get rid of capitalism or the work week.
Was there anything else you wanted to mention that I haven't asked about, or any final thoughts that you wanted to share?
The only thing that I think was something I felt was really important in the talk was the ways in which I believe that my indigenous teachings or my worldviews or spirituality lend themselves to, like, an ecological politics. I see similar compatible politics being actually expressed and fleshed out under, like, different anarchist theorists or through struggle in a way that I don't see in a lot of other analysis outside of anarchism. And I think that considering most of the indigenous sovereignty or resurgence struggles or land defense struggles are generally around control or use of land rather than actually land claim. They're against pipeline projects, extractive projects, things like that. And we see the increasing role of the state in those projects. Those are private companies. Those are very much state projects. And we see this with, like, the recent purchase of Kinder Morgan. When it looked as though indigenous camps were going to shut down that pipeline, the government bought it. Because that's really just the corporations that run those things are just doing it on behalf of the state. And so that the conflict at the root of that is actually between groups of people that have an idea that land and water have an inherent value beyond the dollar and the states that need those projects to continue in order to function and continue to have the revenue streams that it needs to enforce its dominance over a particular territory. And so that is almost like this third arm of that, of like, well, my ecological politics seemingly only really align under anarchist theory as well, because I don't believe that there will be any sort of land or water justice should a state system still exist. And I touched on it only once in the piece, and I said that basically if there were no centralized state, it wouldn't be as easy to create sacrifice zones. And these huge destructive projects often necessitate that sort of centralized authority in order to just seize land or destroy it. And when people are very much rooted to the land they're on, they're much less likely to engage in like huge destructive projects that are going to sacrifice their own ability to live in that area anymore. I think that's a whole different conversation as well. And a lot of the environmental groups that I've been in that didn't have explicitly anarchist focus seem to always fall short at that point as well. They're always looking for state-based solutions to the climate crisis without recognizing that not only probably stalls any sort of climate justice from happening, but is also probably sabotaging Indigenous sovereignty at the same time that they claim to support it.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with me and sharing your thoughts about this. I hope that we'll continue to talk about these things, because I think this is some really important stuff.
Thank you. That was really good. That's great. Thanks for thinking I'm smart and wanting me to do an interview.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to read a transcript of the talk from earlier in the episode, you can find one at North Shore Counter Info. That's north-shore.info, a Southern Ontario anarchist counter-information website. And there's also an imposed or booklet formatted print version you can download. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at fromembers@riseup.net. See you next week.
Of the government, we are the enemy.
In a world where there is no government, anarchy rules. This summer, get ready for the most action-packed podcast.
We continue fighting because we hate all authority and love freedom, which cannot be given but must be taken.
Such zines as This is not a dialogue. A crime called freedom. Party's over. And many, many more.
For more text and audio material of interest to anarchists,
check out ResonanceAudioDistro.org.